So when you talk about breathing, there is another thing I think it's important to point out. We are emotional beings, amongst other things. My speech is what we say is volitional, but when I laugh, when I cry, that's emotional. And that is coming from a different part of the brain than the volitional control. So a poker player, you may have a tell, and that tell may have nothing to do with volition, but to do with emotion. You know, you have two pocket aces. You may respond in ways that your heart rate increases, your pupils dilate and whatnot, and you don't have volitional control over that.
Hey everyone, Ronan here. If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you've undoubtedly heard me say something along the lines of stay curious, breathe properly, and eat your beets. I've never been a fan of beets, especially when they surprise you with a blood-colored pea, and staying curious is what this podcast is all about. But we've never really explored breathing. In fact, most of us take breathing for granted and spend very little time thinking about it. But do a little digging and you'll find our breath is one of the most powerful tools we have for changing our state of mind. In fact, my biggest psychedelic experience so far involved absolutely no drugs, but only my breath. It was in some ways much more intense than any experience with 5-MeO-DMT. So with so much goodness in our breath, why don't we explore it more? Well, today we shall. Our guest on this episode is Dr. Jack Feldman. Jack is a neuroscientist, the David Geffen School of Medicine Chair in Neuroscience, and Distinguished Professor of Neurobiology at the University of California, Los Angeles. For anyone listening who is a fan of Huberman and the physiological psi, you can thank Jack's research for making that a thing. So take a deep breath, folks. This is going to be a good one. Two quick notes before we hop in. First is that today's episode is sponsored by Sizzle Brands. While Quench doesn't make your breathing any better, it does taste awesome and hydrates you properly. Second, this episode was recorded earlier this year, so if there are some dates that seem out of place, that's why. Enjoy the conversation. You have developed a professional reputation in your study of respiration, but that was not your original destiny, as we talked about in our brief preparation phone call. Can you tell me, initially you had intended or did start studying physics and something changed course for you? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, sure. I was a physics nerd and interested in a lot of things about how things work. I grew up with being curious about how things worked. Back in the old days where mechanical watches were cheap, I managed to take them apart to figure out how they worked. I never quite succeeded in putting them back together, but I was good at taking them apart. So I was always interested in the internal workings of things. And of course, physics is a natural way to be drawn into that. And I hung out on a street corner in Brooklyn where I had friends who were much wittier than I was. And I realized that I might not succeed or enjoy myself in the world of words, but in the world of physics, I might be able to thrive, and I really love that. And I went to graduate school intent on becoming a cosmologist, interested in things like space and time. And, you know, nowadays there's an enormous amount of interest in that. But back then it was amongst a much smaller group of people. And I went to an institution that had the person who was renowned as probably the best cosmologist in the world. He went on several years later to win the Nobel Prize. So I guess he really did have bona fides. And while I was in graduate school, I did some self-experimentation. I guess nowadays it's fair to say that it was with psychedelics. And I came to the realization that my perception of space and time was extremely plastic. So while I understood why physicists thought space and time could be have a certain degree of plasticity, it was governed by particular laws that people were in the process of discovering. But the whole notion that my brain determined how I perceived space and time was sort of a revelation to me. And I read up like crazy about the brain. I got fascinated by the brain. And fortunately, I went to an institution that was very ecumenical about how one pursues one's PhD studies in physics. And I managed to convince a very renowned physicist who was interested in mathematical models of how the brain worked to do a thesis on that. And he was a little bit scared about my proposal because he thought it was an impossible problem. So he said, look, I'm only going to let you do it if you find something that is doable. There are too many problems in the brain that are impossible. So I read a lot, and I came down to two problems. One was vision, and the other was breathing. And there were a lot of people working on vision at the time, models of vision. And I thought I could work on breathing, solve the problem. It looked like it was pretty trivial, and then go on to much more, what I thought were much more interesting problems about how the brain worked. And I developed a mathematical model that explained a lot of phenomena based on the published literature, and got my degree, and then looked for a laboratory where I could do postdoctoral research as a modeler, as a theoretician. I had no desire to get my hands dirty doing experiments. But for better or worse, at that time, modeling was not considered to be a very hot topic. And none of the labs that I was interested in really was welcoming about someone who only wanted to do modeling. And so I decided I was going to do experiments. I took a course in learning how to do so at Woods Hole, the Marine Biological Laboratory, and partly motivated by my own experience as a university student during the Vietnam War. I wanted a little bit perspective on American culture, so I chose to do a postdoc in Paris, getting away from American culture, but not giving up on my hedonistic tendencies living in Paris. And so I started doing experiments, looking at breathing, and I found that a lot of the literature that I based my models on was not quite correct. And I spent a lot of time doing experiments, trying to get the record straight. And as I did that, I began to dig deeper and deeper and found that I had to find new ways to do experiments, which I did. And I found out basically that most of the literature was wrong. And we came up with a whole bunch of new ideas, which it turns out seemed to be more or less on target. And this was 30 years ago. So it's been a long time that these things have been established. A
few questions in there. First of all, just because of my background and interest in psychedelics, do you remember what the kind of thought process was during that journey where you're like, let's study the brain more than pure cosmological physics?
Well, to be quite candid, I didn't have very high motivations in using psychedelics. It was something that my friends were doing. It seemed like it would be interesting. And it was that I was at the University of Chicago, which is maybe one of the epicenters outside of the coast where people are exploring that. We had some brilliant chemists who made synthetic versions of some of the psychedelics, which in retrospect was probably not a wise thing to do, but at the time did not cause, it doesn't appear to have caused any problems. Maybe I was a lot smarter then and not as smart now, but I think it gave me a lot of perspectives on the world that I would not have had otherwise. And I don't claim to be particularly enlightened, but I think that it allowed me to sort of get outside of a fairly narrow framework of thinking about the world, and embraced a lot and realized how much the brain really determined everything about the way the world was. And so that started me on my journey. And I find it extraordinarily interesting now that it's come back full circle where society in general, or maybe not in general, but a large segment of society that can influence this has realized that psychedelic drugs can have positive benefit in particularly in treating many diseases that have been refractory to other forms of therapy.
For sure. Are you familiar, just because it seems to intersect very closely with the work of Don Hoffman and the case of Against Reality and his exploration of physics and the fundamental units or basis of the universe?
No, I'm not familiar with that work, but I will say I've explored a lot of things that are sort of between perception and brain function and hardcore physics, which is simply manipulating equations on a piece of paper and tying it to concepts in the real world, and realize that while my own personal view is that physics does explain a lot about the world, there's a lot that's unanswered, there's a lot that's unknown. I mean, it's amazing that we have things called dark energy and dark matter that take up a significant component of the universe, and we're pretty clueless as to what they are. There's two things I hope I can live long enough. One is to see my grandchildren grow up, and two, to have someone tell me what dark matter and dark energy is.
Yeah.
Then I can go.
All right. Two criteria. Sound like a good one. Yeah. So the basic thesis of Don Hoffman's work is twofold. One is that all species have not evolved to perceive reality as it is. We perceive reality as it serves natural selection, right? So the fact that I'm staring at a computer screen looking at you may have no bearing on the truth of the nature of reality around us. It's just how our brain and our, biological infrastructure perceives it and translates it to ensure survival, but may not be connected. And then the second piece of his work in the case against reality is that the basic unit of the universe, it's not a, you know, whatever kind of indivisible, continually divisible unit of matter, but that the fundamental unit of the universe is consciousness. And we're just all, you know, all of our laws of physics are a lens through which we model experience, but it's not necessarily reflective of true laws of nature kind of thing. It's fascinating work, and he's trying to distill that down, as you said, into a large mathematical equation, and it'll be interesting to see if it works, but it is a very fascinating perspective.
Well, the notion that we do not perceive the world as it is been known probably for hundreds of years. I mean, all you have to do is look at hundreds of optical illusions where you can immediately see that our brain, no matter how much we try and convince ourselves that those lines are parallel, that we can't see them as such. And there's a beautiful book written by my colleague Dean Bartimona called Brain Bugs. And in the book, he discusses how our brain takes the information that it perceives from the outside world, which of course is highly filtered. Our eyes only see certain frequencies of light. Our ears only hear certain frequencies of sound, and so on. That we really already highly filter the world that we take into our brain. And then we treat it in ways that, through evolution, appear to be highly biased to increase the likelihood of survival and not necessarily representing the truth. So if a distortion was better for survival, that's what became embedded in our brains. And I fully subscribe to that. I mean, I think there's been a lot of interest recently in the concept of free will. And there's a beautiful book by Robert Sapolsky, a renowned neuroscientist, about this. And he goes and does a fairly deep dive into the notion of free will and comes out the other end saying, I can't find it. And I happen to agree with him that I can't find a source for free will and willing to accept the fact there's no free will. But what I think is important is I have the illusion of free will. And I think the illusion of free will is actually quite critical for the human condition, for us being social beings and whatnot. If we lost the illusion of free will, I think it would create havoc. But it's hard for me to totally reconcile or even partially reconcile my belief that we don't have free will with the notion that the illusion is actually a very important thing in the way we go around in the world.
I know this is not your area of expertise, so I'm going to ask you to speculate, but what would be the evolutionary rationale for not having free will or the illusion of free will?
Well, I think the illusion of free will works. And if we take the statement that there is no free will to the fullest extent, then we have all sorts of problems that I don't think there's a ready solution. For example, you have someone who commits a heinous crime. Right. We consider them responsible and we punish them according to cultural metrics appropriately. If we fully adopt the lack of free will, then you can say, well, the person who committed a heinous crime had no control over it, and therefore punishing them is not the right solution. And I think that that's a paradox our society is not prepared to deal with. If we accept free will, then we say, okay, person who committed the heinous crime had some control over that, and therefore the society can take some measures that might be considered punitive in order to deal with it, both with respect to the individual and with respect to societal norms.
Right. That's fair. Yeah, I remember hearing actually a podcast about that very subject, that we'll eventually find that almost all of our behaviors are encoded in our DNA. Getting close to, I don't know if it was actually a supposition that there is no free will, but getting close to that, that almost everything could be predicted through our genetics, well, and then you take our...
I won't go so far as to say is encoded in our free will, because, I mean, encoded in our DNA, because our DNA sets a baseline. So it sets a baseline of what colors we can perceive, what sounds we can hear, but experience also changes that. And right. So you have experience, and for example, psychedelics, you have an experience that can change the configuration of your brain in ways that, given a particular situation, you may respond differently after than before, but it doesn't mean you had free will. It means that simply the conditions of your brain have changed. So I think it's a combination of your genetic heritage, but also your experience that determines the state of your brain and how it interacts with the world.
That's fair. I suppose the line of thinking was we only have a certain set of DNA within which we can work. So the parameters of what we can experience are limited. But your point is well taken. It's interesting too, because, you know, going back to the conversation about breathing, we think about the fact that, and I know I've heard you talk about it, we have autonomic breathing and we have volitional breathing. And when you think about the word volitional, it seems to impute some degree of conscious control, even if there's no free will. That's not really the point of the question. But it's interesting how the presumption of free will is evident in just about everything we talk about in so many ways.
I hate to raise this because it's going down the rabbit hole. I think what we call volitional and what we call consciousness, we have to be a little bit careful about that. There's a lot of discussion now, not just by philosophers, but by neuroscientists about what consciousness is, the role it plays in any actions. And there are sort of extremes of this. There are people who believe that everything has a consciousness, electrons, yep, photons, and whatnot. And then there are people who believe that consciousness is sort of epiphenomenal, that it's just sort of a ghost in the machine, but it's not playing any particular role in anything we do. It's just an illusion. So I'm not sure that's a topic that I'm prepared to get in at 7 o'clock in the morning. but I think we have to be careful. Also, when you talk about breathing, there is another thing I think it's important to point out. We are emotional beings, amongst other things. And yep, there's a mode of control of breathing, which is very important. So my speech is what we say is volitional. My regulation with respect to oxygen, carbon dioxide is regulatory, homeostatic, whatever term you want to use. But when I laugh, when I cry, that's emotional. And that is coming from a different part of the brain than the volitional control. So the emotional control of movement is very interesting, because as primates, we use facial expression as a way of communicating. So nonverbal communication. And that seems to be under control, not of the volitional part of the brain, but this emotional part of the brain. And we have, you know, sometimes we'll be challenged. If you're a poker player, you may have a tell, and that tell may have nothing to do with volition, but to do with emotion. You know, you see, right. You have, you know, two aces, two pocket aces. You may respond in ways that your heart rate increases, your pupils dilate and whatnot, and you don't have much volitional control over that.
Yeah, for sure. I want to get into that more, but I wanted to ask, academically, you're maybe best known, I won't say probably, for identifying the part of the brain that controls breathing. It's called the pre-Butzinger complex. When I saw you speak at the Brain Mind Summit, I thought, well, Butzinger is an interesting term. I had assumed it was in homage to some famous scientist that had come before you, but that's not the case, is it?
No, this is often confused, or people want to believe it's a famous German or Austrian neuroscientist. Even ChatGPT, in its earliest rendition, attributed the discovery to a neuroscientist whose last name was Butzinger. But this is not the case. Butzinger is actually an appellation for a wine region in Germany. And the story I've told at length numerous times, I have an interview on the BBC about this, but in brief, yeah. I had a colleague who had argued that another region of the brain was critical, and he severely criticized me at an international meeting for identifying this other region, which he said did exist, was crap and whatnot. And then a year later, comes back to the same group of people in Germany at another meeting and tries to take claim for the discovery of this other region. And that concerned me, not really concerned me, got really bent out of shape. And yep. There's a tradition in science, even neuroscience, that things are named after people. To have regions of the brain named Broca's area, Wernicke's area, named after neuroscientists who worked in that area. And I felt that this guy was pushing to have this region named after him, even though he had nothing to do with its primary discovery. And so at the banquet we had for this meeting, which was the last evening, and there's about 100 of us, we were all a little bit inebriated, and I got a little nervous that people were buzzing about naming it after this other guy, and I clicked my wine glass, stood up, and said we should celebrate the discovery of this new region, this identification. And because it's not identified in any of these maps of the brain, we have the privilege of naming it. And I was not clever enough before I started to talk to think of what I was going to propose for a name. And the only text that I could see as I looked around desperately to find something was this bottle of wine, which was called Butzinger wine. It was a Pinot Grigio, if I remember correctly. And I picked up the bottle of wine and said, because we're all celebrating drinking this wine, why don't we name it after Butzinger? And because it's complicated, we can call it the Butzinger complex. And everyone was sufficiently drunk that everyone agreed, and that's what happened. Turns out the Butzinger complex was not the rhythm-generating region, but is a region just nearby, just a little bit lower on the nervous system, so down towards the spinal cord. So the Butzinger complex was in the brain stem, which is sort of the back of the head here in the, yeah. in the nervous system. It's where the spinal cord goes up and meets the larger parts of the brain. And we discovered several years later that there was a region just behind it that was generating the rhythm, or at least we hypothesized that. And here again, we took the liberty of naming it, and we made a decision. The convention in naming things in the nervous system has it that if you're behind it, in other words, towards the tail, you name it post. So you have a region right. called X. If you're just behind it, you would call it post X. If it's in front of it, that is towards the head, you would name it pre-X. But we thought naming this region post-Butzinger, because it was near Butzinger, would convey the wrong idea, because we thought it was the source of the rhythm, and there would be sort of cognitive dissonance between post and the source. So we took the liberty of naming it pre-Butzinger. And the thing that we published this in an abstract, but a year later we published our first paper on this, and it was in a major journal, the journal Science, where it was in the title. And once it's in the title of a journal like that, it tends to stick, and it's just stuck. So that's how we named it.
I want you to talk about, because I know in your talk at the Brain Mind Summit and elsewhere, you've talked about how you've demonstrated the control, for lack of a better word, that the pre-Butzinger complex has on our breathing. But for everybody who is listening, who is new to the neurology of breathing, can you give us a kind of layman's overview of what's going on and how our brains control the breathing process?
Absolutely. So a general strategy amongst neuroscientists, if they want to try and understand what a particular small region of the brain does, is either to interfere with it in ways that decrease its activity, including ablating, or that's a polite term for killing the cells in that region. So you just knock out all the cells in that region and see what happens to the animal's behavior. Nature does this in humans when there's a stroke or a lesion in a region. It knocks out that region, and we watch the behavior, and we know from studying individuals who have strokes in almost every subregion of the brain, we have some idea what the loss of that population of neurons is responsible for. Now, that only gives a partial answer, and it could be a misleading one. For example, if I have my television set and I unplug it from the wall, my television set doesn't work, but it would be an error to conclude that the picture was coming from the plug in the wall. So you have to do some other experiment. It means the plug is necessary, but it doesn't completely define what that is. And of course, we know that it's providing the power for all those circuits, but not in and of itself providing the details of the picture. So similarly with a brain region, when it gets knocked out for regions of a lesion or a stroke or an experimental ablation, we're sort of left with trying to figure out what it does. Now, there are other ways to try and get around that. And one way is not to simply knock it down, but to control its activity. And so we have ways now to control the activity of a particular population of cells, where we can make it more active or less active. So that said, first, the experiment we did with the pre-Butzinger complex is we put in a slowly acting toxin into just that region of the brain, which is very tiny. It's like, like a 25th of an inch in diameter, a few hundred microns in diameter on both sides of the brain. And we put in a special toxin that only killed the cells in that region. And we found that when we did this in rats, they had significant disturbances in their breathing pattern. And they never recovered a normal breathing pattern. And their breathing patterns became so disturbed that we sacrificed the animals so they would not suffer. But the disturbances were profound. It was so profound that when they would try to go to sleep, there's a change in the chemicals affecting breathing when you go to sleep. When they would go to sleep, they would literally stop any breathing movements. And really? So we would sacrifice the animals at that point. We then do a more subtle experiment, where instead of killing the neurons, we were able to just turn them off for a short period of time. We just turn them off and watch what happened. And when we turn them off, here again in rats, the rats stopped breathing. So if we did it for a very short period of time, we would mechanically ventilate the rat so the rat would continue breathing, but it generated no breathing movements of its own. And then after a few minutes, the rat recovered because the way in which we stopped the activity of these neurons only lasted for a couple of minutes, and the animal recovered and breathed normally like nothing ever happened. So that was on the decreasing activity side. And we've done, and now a lot of other people have done experiments where we increase the activity. And when we increase the activity, breathing increases. So these things and a lot of other things coming together suggest, well, let me explain another experiment we did. We mapped the connections from the diaphragm, which is the principal inspiratory muscle. Those are muscles that are active when motor neurons, these are special neurons in the spinal cord, become active. And so those motor neurons become active periodically. And when they're active, the diaphragm contracts. We have inspiration. Now, the motor neurons themselves are not generating the breathing rhythm. They're passive. They receive an input that generates the breathing rhythm. So we had a way of mapping the projections into those motor neurons. We went back one level, and we went back one level. Those neurons were active during inspiration and quiet during expiration, so they were driving the rhythm. But it turned out that those neurons themselves were not driving the rhythm. We had to go back one more neuron. And when we went back one more, it was the Prebutzinger complex. And we did not require any inputs to the Prebutzinger complex to generate the rhythm. So as we traced it back to its source, and the source was the Prebutzinger complex. So these things come together, and it's now generally accepted that the Prebutzinger complex is the site in the brain where we have the origin of the breathing, the inspiratory breathing rhythm. We subsequently discovered that expiratory movements, the are not generated by the Prebutzinger complex. We originally thought it was all coming from one place. You might think, for example, we have oscillations of day and night. That all comes from one place, the earth going around and around. And we thought that the Prebutzinger complex going through its cycle would do inspiration and expiration. It turns out that's not the case, that there's another oscillator that generates expiratory movements, and they're tightly coupled between inspiration and expiration. So you see this inspiration, expiration. The reason we miss that oscillator is that under normal conditions, the expiratory oscillator is quiet. So while you and I are sitting here quiet, not when we're talking, but if we're just sitting here quietly, we inspire and relax. We don't actively contract our expiratory muscles. We inhale, and the elasticity of the lung and the rib cage just bring us back. We go. Now, that seems to be the breathing pattern that's most efficient. And because we breathe 24/7 continuously, there's a strong evolutionary advantage to animals that breathe more efficiently. And it turns out that for the body that we have and all mammals have, the most efficient breathing pattern is active expiration with the diaphragm, passive expiration. But there are instances where we have to increase our ventilation, for example, during exercise. And we're not able to do that just by inspiring more deeply and more frequently. We bring in now expiration. We go, and that involves different sets of muscles. It involves expiratory muscles in the abdominals. So you contract your abdominals, and that squeezes the lung and it forces the air out. So now we have two oscillators that are interacting, but the expiratory one is normally quiet. And so when we think about ways in which we can manipulate our breathing pattern, we could do it by manipulating inspiration, or we could do it by manipulating expiration. And of course, I'm manipulating my breathing pattern when I speak because I'm having controlled expiratory airflow. And then I take periodic pauses to inhale, which for reasons having to do with social communication, we don't really notice. We don't notice that people are constantly stopping during speech to inhale. So we have these two oscillators.
All right, let me see if I can summarize that correctly. So we have the Prebutzinger complex which your experiments show are the source of the rhythm for inspiration. So it, you know, something's happening in the pre-Butzinger complex that triggers some neurons, which triggers some neurons, which trigger neurons in our, or cells in our diaphragm that cause our diaphragm to expand. It contracts the muscles, so we inhale. Is that correct?
Yes, but I should add one stipulation. The airways have to be open, have to be patent.
Right.
And I bring this up because a serious population-wide public health problem is that during sleep, the muscles of the upper airways, particularly the tongue, lose tone, and the airways can begin to constrict or collapse, and you can get snoring, but even worse, you can get the tongue to collapse against the back of the airways, and you get obstruction, and you get central, what's called obstructive sleep apnea. So even though your diaphragm is contracting, the airways are closed. So you're correct. Under normal circumstances, during wakefulness, we're fine. There's a large cohort of people during sleep where they get these periodic obstructions. And even though their diaphragm is being activated rhythmically, there's no airflow.
Right. Okay. Yeah. No, that makes sense. So inspiration is kind of autonomic. And then the expiration or exhale is just kind of all the muscles relaxing, right? And
I don't mean to be a dilettante, but
no, it's okay.
Breathing is not autonomic. Autonomic refers to the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, which involve smooth muscles and glands.
Okay.
Breathing involves skeletal muscles. It's just skeletal muscles like flexing your biceps and flexing your elbow. So it's not autonomic. The combination of autonomic and breathing form a bigger part of the nervous system, which you would call the regulatory nervous system. But it's confusing because a lot of the interest in public health and about stress and whatnot has to do with direct actions on the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic and parasympathetic. But those pathways controlling them, it's separate pathways controlling the skeletal muscles that are involved in breathing.
Right. Okay. That was a misuse of my of the word autonomic, but I appreciate the clarification. We have the pre-Butzinger complex driving the inspiration, and then there's the expiration, which it, under normal circumstances is just the relaxation of the muscles, which pushes the air out, right? Okay.
Yes.
Now, I remember seeing in one of your talks a study that looked at people who had locked-in syndrome. Can you walk us through that? I found that fascinating.
Yeah, so this is not my work. It's work of many other investigators, including some colleagues. So locked-in syndrome is the result of a significant stroke in a particular part of the brainstem called the pons, and a particular side of the pons, the ventral pons. Now, this is the part of the brainstem where signals coming from the cortex go down through the brainstem to the spinal cord to control all the muscles of your body except some of your face and eyes. So when you get this lesion, these individuals lose the ability to make volitional movements. The movements that are preserved are twofold. They can make movements of the eyes, particularly lateral movements, and in many cases they can blink. And that's because the control of those volitional movements are on the other side of the lesion. That is, the connections between the cortex and the regions controlling those eye movements and blinking are not affected. The other movements that are not affected are breathing movements, because the critical structures like the pre-Butzinger complex are on the other side of the lesion. So in other words, they can't be affected by the volitional pathways which come into them, but their projections, connections to the muscles driving breathing are still intact. So an individual who has locked-in syndrome is able to maintain normal intelligence, normal perception of the world, but they can't move. So if they're mechanically ventilated and fed, They can survive, and they can communicate through blinking or moving their eyes. Now, one of these patients were being studied by colleagues in London, and the patient had a very metronomic breathing pattern. And they asked the patient to hold his breath, and the patient, nothing changed. It stayed robotic. The patient blinks, saying they're trying to hold their breath, but nothing changed. They asked the patient to breathe faster. Here again, no change in breathing pattern. But if they gave the patient a breathing mixture with low oxygen, just like in normal individuals, breathing increased. If they gave the individual a little bit of breathing mixture, a little bit of carbon dioxide, breathing increased. So the regulation of breathing seemed to be pretty much intact, but there was no volitional control of breathing. And in studying this patient, the patient just had this regular breathing pattern. Then all of a sudden, the patient's breathing pattern changed. And they, where'd this come from? And they said to the patient, what happened? And the patient responded, here again, by blinking to his caretaker, you told a joke and I laughed. And it turns out whenever they told a joke that the patient found funny, the patient's breathing pattern became one of these stereotyped laugh patterns. We have all have a very stereotyped laugh pattern. You know, it sort of usually involves an inhale, ha, ha, ha. However, we all know individuals who have very unusual laughing patterns. This is coming from a different part of the brain, as I mentioned earlier, the emotional control of breathing. And that is still present. And you see this in locked-in patients. If you say to a locked-in patient, smile, they can't smile. Now, if I said to you, smile, you could fake a smile. You know, you could do something like saying cheese. But if I'm reasonably perceptive, I could tell you that's a fake smile. That's not, you're not really joyous. However, if they show the patient something that the patient finds joyful, like a loved one or a sunset, the patient could smile. So that emotive part of expression remains intact. And this is very important, again, here for primate human communication, is we use these facial expressions. So that's why being face-to-face and looking at someone when you're talking to them, you can often tell whether they're happy, sad, whether they're paying attention, so on and so forth, not through verbal, but through nonverbal means. So it says that there's this nonverbal emotional connection affecting breathing, but the volitional control is absent. There's a beautiful book called The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, written by a relatively young French man who was an editor of one of the important fashion magazines. And it's a great testimony to the human will that he survived and looked at this as something that was livable. There was a movie made out of this. And unfortunately, he passed away still as a young man. But it's a remarkable book. It's not just about breathing. It's really about the human will to face up to things that most of us would consider to be just unimaginable.
Totally. That's a great segue to talk about, emotion. So just so I'm clear on what you were just saying, is that we have this regulatory system that causes us to breathe in normal circumstances, but in locked-in syndrome, that gets disrupted. And through mechanical ventilation, people can continue to breathe normally and in an oscillating
pattern. I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. They can continue to breathe normally without any intervention because the structures that are involved, the pre-Butzinger complex, are sitting below, like if we're upright, sitting below, and still maintain their connections to the spinal cord. So that their breathing is perfectly normal. They do not need to be mechanically ventilated. They just cannot volitionally change their breathing pattern.
Right. They can't. That's right. They can't, I was going to say consciously, but volitionally change their breathing pattern. But if you make them laugh, you can change their breathing pattern because it's coming from a different part of the brain that controls emotion.
With the connections coming down through a different part of the brainstem that's not affected by the lesion.
So fascinating.
That's amazing.
But that's a great segue to talk about, you know, breathing and emotional regulation. What is, I mean, we know it, like everyone's told, been told at some points, even though it's probably the most frustrating advice you can get when you're really heated, to take a deep breath, but we know that breath can regulate emotion. Why is that?
Okay. I'm going to be a little bit speculative here. I was fortunate to do a wonderful study with some colleagues at Stanford, Kevin Yackel, Peng Li, Mark Krasnow, where we actually identified critical structures for generating what you call physiological size. That is, in order to maintain a very high level of metabolism, including our big brains, we have to continually take in large amounts of oxygen. One of the ways we're able to do that is our lung evolved from amphibians or reptiles into mammals into having a huge surface area for movement of oxygen from air in the lung into the bloodstream and carbon dioxide from the bloodstream into the lung and then out. So whereas a amphibian lung starts out with one airway, the trachea, branches, and may only branch about 6 or 7 times, and has relatively large alveoli, and has very much more limited surface area. Ours branches over 20 times. And so our alveoli are very small. They're 100 microns, and 100 to 200 microns in diameter, and we have 400 to 500 million of them. So even though they're very tiny, when you look at the surface area, take a 400 or 500 million times, it's about 70 square meters. You're Canadian, so you're okay with meters, but it's about a third the size of a tennis court. So that's that huge, we have this huge membrane that we have to expand and contract. And that's where the diaphragm comes in. So mammals are the only class of vertebrates that have a diaphragm. I've said before, and people have made a meme out of this, without a diaphragm, you're an amphibian. But there's a price you pay for this. The alveoli are very tiny, and in order to work, they're fluid line. So they're able to expand and contract appropriately. Now, because they're so tiny, they have a very small probability of collapsing. Now, because there's 500 million of them, a small probability means that they're collapsing all the time. And as you might know, if you ever tried blowing up a balloon that is wet on the inside and the sides are sticking to each other, it's very hard to blow it up. And the reason being is that water sticks to itself. It's called surface tension. And if your listeners don't believe me, take a balloon, fill it with water, get all the water out, make sure it's collapsed, and then try and blow it up. And you realize that it doesn't just blow up immediately. You have to put a lot of pressure for it to blow up. Similarly, with these alveoli that have collapsed, because they've collapsed, a normal breath is not enough to pop them open. You have to take a deep breath. What's a deep breath? A sigh. So, and it turns out that humans sigh about every 5 minutes, 12 times an hour. And if people listening to this podcast don't believe me, and most people are skeptical, just lie down in a quiet room, don't listen to anything, and just pay attention to your normal breathing. And you'll notice every couple of minutes, you take a deep breath without needing to trigger it. So we evolved as mammals this physiological sign. Now it turns out that that single sigh also turns out to be calming. Slows your heartbeat down, you're calmer. Now, why that is the case, can't answer. But if we suppose that an early mammal sighing in order to maintain lung function found it calmer, you could now speculate that this could be an advantage when you're under stressful situations. because if you're a prey and you need to hide, you're a small mammal, you need to hide from a predator. Part of what would give you away is if you're fidgety, breathing heavy and whatnot. And so if you calm down by breathing deep, it would be an advantage. So you could, here again, it's great speculation. You can imagine that this gives some advantage, evolutionary advantage, fitness advantage, and that remains, that these deep breaths turn out to have an advantage. Now, once the brain now takes a breathing-related signal and is calming, you can imagine that it can now use that breathing-related signal for many different things if that's advantageous for calming. Now, I'm not saying that non-human vertebrates normally meditate or breath work, but we did an experiment. We said, is this just a human phenomena? So this only evolved with advances in our higher level function. Or is this an old phenomena? As I'm suggesting, it came from evolution of the sign to help maintain the health of a mammalian lung. So working with a brilliant psychologist who's an expert on fear, we developed an experimental protocol where we could get mice to breathe slowly. So normally mice breathe 5 to 10 per second when they're awake. It's very fast. We could slow them down to maybe 1 per second.
Is that what you described, getting mice to meditate?
Yeah, well, I put meditate in quotes. It was just slowing their breathing down.
Right.
And when we did this, and we did this 30 minutes a day for 4 weeks, the mice were quite content to do this. They didn't seem to be stressed or reactive to this. 30 minutes a day for 4 weeks. And then our colleague, Michael Fanzolo, and his folks would then test these mice for a standard test of fear. So psychologists have developed tests which they find are highly correlated to what we would consider fear, and that there's a thing that they can measure that is an index of how fearful they are. So we looked at mice that we call control mice. These are mice put through all the same procedures, except the procedure that we had to slow our test mice did not slow the control mice. So they went through everything. We had the mice were tested, and they were tested by individuals who did not know whether they were control or test mice. They just were given the mice. And it turns out that the control mice had a level of fearfulness to a particular protocol that was consistent with all previously published work on control mice. We looked at our test mice, they were much less fearful. So our conclusions are as follows. One, it can be seen in more than one mammalian species, and we speculate this is common across all mammalian species. Two, it's not a placebo effect. Now, one of the concerns that one has about breath work is that anyone who does breath work is in a situation where they probably think that it's going to help them be calmer, either because that's what their instructor says or that's what the app says, that's what their belief is. And so as soon as you have a belief something's going to happen, you can have a placebo effect. And we know that placebo effects can be extremely powerful. And I'm not dismissing breath work, but I'm just saying that that's always a concern. The fact that we can see this effect in mice where we don't expect a placebo effect, says that it's not a placebo effect. And the third thing is that the mechanism we use to slow the breathing down, that does not involve volitional control on the part of the mouse. So it means volitional control, which is a critical component of human breath work, is not an obligatory part of the effect it has in the benefits of breath work. So you have to forgive me that I forgot the original question, but
sorry.
We see this as intrinsic part of the nervous system that we as humans now can exploit by particular kinds of manipulation of breathing. And one of the things we're trying to do, a principal focus, is to try and understand what the mechanism is. As I said in the beginning of the podcast, I'm interested in why these things work. Why does breathing have this effect? What is the mechanism? And I think if we understand the mechanism, then we might be able to better exploit breath work for treating a whole variety of things in the human condition, which we consider to be negative.
Right. Yep. Thank you. One of my favorite books, I don't know if you've come across it, is a book called Jitterbug Perfume by Tom Robbins. And one of the stories in Jitterbug Perfume is the story of an ancient king, Alibar, who decides that he doesn't fear death, he resents death. And so he sets out on a mission to find a way to die on his own terms when he wants to, because death barges in and doesn't even wipe his shoes, kind of thing. And one of the storylines is that he discovers how to beat death by three principles, which was stay curious, breathe properly, and eat your beets, because he came from kind of a Slovak region. And it's fascinating. And I'm going to ask you to speculate here, but we know that it seems that caloric restriction seems to have an impact on longevity. And as breathing is, as far as I understand, an essential component of metabolism, do you think there's any association in terms of breathing and longevity? I mean, I know a lot of people are doing breath work right now for the mental and emotional health benefits, and certainly that's going to lower cortisol levels, which is going to lower inflammation levels, et cetera. But I'm curious to know if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, from an evolutionary perspective, breathing more efficiently has an advantage because you're doing it continuously. And studies on non-primate mammals and on humans seems to indicate, I don't think seems to indicates, that the breathing pattern that we choose is at the minimal of energy expenditure. In other words, we breathe at a rate which seems to be optimal. If it was faster or slower, it would be less efficient. And we breathe at a volume which seems to be most efficient for our musculature and our energy expenditure. And I think that that's a, when you talk about things that are built in genetically, I think that that's very, very powerful. Because even if you deviate a few percent from that, in humans, you have serious health problems, and you can even get a perceptive problem called breathlessness when you get a few percent off. So I think that over extended periods of time, it is a challenge to change your overall breathing pattern to save energy. It's about 5 to 7% of your total body metabolism. I don't know the data on longevity, and particularly like centenarians. There's been a lot of interest in centenarians. It seems to me that by and large, they tend to be thinner. So carrying weight around is a challenge to the nervous system. I'm not totally persuaded by extreme calorie restriction, in part because if, for me personally, I don't find it very comfortable. I enjoy good food. I try and keep my weight to be reasonable, and within certain limits. I think for me the goal is not to live as long as possible. I'd like to enjoy my life in certain ways that are not unduly shortening it. So I don't drink a lot, but in spite of the fact that there was a recent publication that any alcohol is no good for you, I'm not prepared to drink no alcohol, but I don't drink a lot. I like good food. You know, we went through a period where things like butter were considered to be bad for you, or fats were considered to be bad for you. And now we realize that at least certain kind of fats are valuable. So I try and strike a balance between the two of them. I think the reduction of stress is probably very important in the long run. And that's where breath work can continue. But I personally don't subscribe that it would be a benefit to me to have a significant caloric restriction, because I think it would raise my stress levels enough that it would counteract whatever benefit I would have from reduced eating. I think being thin is within limits is an advantage. And you know, that's all I can really contribute to this.
No, I appreciate the feedback and the thoughts. At the end of the day, you know, I appreciate not just science, but people's experience and wisdom as much as anything else. A few questions. One is just on the longevity stuff. There's a lot of interest between breathing and HRV, as an example, and you and I had chatted about that at the lunch. You know, I certainly noticed that if I'm using my Apple Watch and do a basic breathing exercise of 5 seconds in, 5 seconds out, my HRV actually goes up quite a bit. Is there, to your knowledge, is there any, what is the data around HRV right now?
So I'm going to get myself in trouble here.
That's all right. I like trouble.
I think there's some degree of controversy about what HRV is telling you. I actually bought an Oura Ring to measure my HRV continuously to do a N=1 experiment to see whether my HRV correlated with my perceived state. Now, I'm what considered to be elderly, although I deny that as often as I can. So my HRV is not in the same range as yours and many of your listeners. And there's not as much data as I would like about people my age. But what I found, now I've had my Oura Ring about a year, is that on days that I feel yicky, sluggish, my HRV tends to be lower, particularly during sleep, which is considered in general to be not an optimal sign. And on days that I feel robust and, you know, super, my HRV is higher. Those are sort of the extremes, I would say, 10% on one side, 10% on the other side. In the middle 80%, for me personally, I don't find much of a correlation between my HRV and my self-perception, which I realize is a terrible experimental measurement, but it's all I have to work with. You know, I do measure things like blood pressure and whatnot, and I don't seem to find much of a correlation outside of those two extremes. And on the extreme where my HRV is low, are days where I feel stressed, I have grants that are due, I have stuff I have to do that I haven't done yet. My wife is on my case about not doing stuff around the house. And days, you know, where I'm in a great mood, I got a grant funded, I spent a great day with my grandkids, my HRV is higher. So, I mean, I definitely see that, but I don't look at my HRV as something that I'm trying to optimize. I'm looking at things that will reduce my stress levels to sort of be calmer. So I think exercise is probably the best thing ever, the best drug you could possibly take, notwithstanding psychedelics or special cases. But as a day-to-day thing, exercise is the greatest. I find breath work to be extremely helpful, both acutely. I was speaking to Tanya Bentley the other day, who wrote this beautiful review of the literature on breath work. And she says that 5 minutes a day is a sweet spot, that you don't need to do 30 minutes a day, that 5 minutes a day has definite effects, and you need to do it often,
right?
Not necessarily every day. But the published literature, and she did a real sort of hardcore scientific view of the literature, really, that really pops out. There are a lot of studies on breathing and various aspects of health, which are underpowered and anecdotal and sort of feed into what you think the authors already believe. And as much as we would like them to be true, I think as scientists, we have to be a little bit hands off. But there are a handful of powerful studies. And every day there's something new. There was an interesting study that I know you are interested in, that holotropic breathing, which is I wouldn't say extreme form, but a particular form of breathing, seems to induce a psychedelic kind of mind state. And that the authors argue that this may be an alternative way of bringing people into a mental state comparable that may have considerable benefits for individuals who have clinical challenges to their mental health.
Yep. I was going to ask about that. But before we go to that, the study that you're referring to with Tanya about 5 minutes a day, what kind of breathing activity was involved in that?
Box breathing, 4-7-8. Okay. I think the pretty much the entry level. It's a little bit like the data that is coming out with exercise, that if you have someone who doesn't exercise, the greatest benefit is when someone who doesn't exercise begins to exercise. When you look at exercise levels, there are incremental changes with more exercise, different kinds of exercise. But the biggest benefit is getting off your butt and exercising. And I think the biggest benefit is seen in people who don't do breath work to doing 5 minutes a day. For people who are more experienced, longer periods are not detrimental. They could be significantly beneficial, but the incremental benefit is going to be less than the individual showing 5 minutes a day. And I think that's one of the things in those kinds of review studies that are going to pop out.
Gotcha. Okay. And speaking of the holotropic breath work, I can say from personal experience, it does induce an altered state of consciousness. There's no doubt in my mind. I don't know if you've tried have you tried holotropic breath work yet?
Yes, I have. And I have to say it was pretty amazing experience. But for me, it was a little bit uncomfortable doing it. The instructor really pushed us hard, but I felt exhilarated afterwards. But I've not gone back and done it again because it was a little bit uncomfortable. But I keep trying to convince myself I got to do it again because of the I don't know if I would say it was psychedelic like, but it was really exhilarating when it was done. And I think the exhilaration wasn't because, thank God, I'm finished. It was a result of the period of doing that intense breathing effort.
Right. So during breath work, I'm going to ask you to speculate about it, if you don't mind, about like what may induce that psychedelic-like experience, if you have any ideas or speculations about it. But before we get there, based on my knowledge of some of these breathing activities, what's happening is your oxygen level isn't changing. Your oxygen saturation is usually pretty set. But what is happening is that as you are breathing much faster, you're blowing off a lot of carbon dioxide. So, you know, the carbon dioxide levels in your blood are declining. Is that correct? And then often in these breathwork sessions, they ask you to do a hold. And I remember from an experience working with some free driving instructors, when you it's the CO2 in your blood, the CO2 levels in your blood that causes the discomfort when you hold your breath, right? It's not necessarily the oxygen levels. So when you blow off so much carbon dioxide, you can hold your breath for a lot longer because you don't have that level of discomfort. And then your CO2 slowly starts to creep up and your O2 starts to decrease over time. Is that an accurate assessment of what's happening during breathwork sessions?
Well, so there's two issues there. One is that when you greatly increase your ventilation above normal, your oxygen level saturation, as you rightly point out, is about 98% at rest. It could be a little bit lower, but it's pretty well saturated, and you're not going to bring it up very much. but your CO2 levels can drop significantly, and there's an acute response to your CO2 level. That is, as your CO2 level drops, your pH, your acid-base balance, your pH goes up, which means you're more alkalotic, not acidic. Alkalotic is the other direction. And yep. Every tissue in your body has its behavior affected by what the pH is, particularly your brain. The brain is really interested in pH levels. So when you change your pH levels, as you almost certainly do during an intense holotropic breathing session, you're going to become hypocapnic, that is low CO2, and alkalotic, and that can readily affect brain function, and that could be contributing. The other thing is that intense exercise seems to induce the release of various compounds. So there's a lot of work now saying that resistance exercise releases compounds from your muscles that are very beneficial to health. And your breathing muscles are muscles. So right. Those things are getting released from those muscles that can make you feel exhilarated. And also there amongst these things that may be induced are release of endogenous opioids or enkephalins. And that also has an effect on your body function. So there are lots of things that could be happening. Now, with respect to free divers, I think we have to be a little bit careful. I think there's reason to believe that the most successful free divers are genetically different than you and me.
Right.
There's a particular gene called the FOX2B gene that is very important in the ability to detect carbon dioxide. In extreme circumstances where there's mutation in the FOX2B gene, and this mutation involves what's called a triplet repeat, that a particular part of the DNA coding for this gene is repeated ABC, 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 and that in most of us, it has a handful of repeats, but in people who have the extended repeats, I think it's 30 or more, have this disorder at birth called central congenital hyperventilation syndrome. They have a lot of difficulty breathing at birth. If this mutation is detected, they're ventilated. And when they're ventilated, they can develop more or less normally. And what I mean by ventilated, they have a tube placed in their trachea, and they have to be connected to a ventilator, particularly when they sleep. They seem to breathe okay when they're awake. So this is called CCHS. Now, if you look at kids who have CCHS, and this is work of my colleague Debbie Wiesmeyer, who's a pediatric neurologist, she points out that these kids have noticeable facial anomalies. There are slight differences in their facial appearance, which is noticeable.
Right.
She was watching a documentary on free diving breath world record breath holders, and she noticed that many of these individuals had similar facial anomalies to those her kids who had CCHS. But these individuals were not symptomatic to CCHS. Now, individuals with CCHS are very insensitive to CO2 levels. They can hold their breath almost forever until they pass out. It's obviously very dangerous. And so you can imagine that individuals who have more of these triplet repeats than normal individuals, but not enough to be symptomatic, are less sensitive to CO2 and therefore can tolerate higher levels of CO2 than most normal individuals. This would obviously be beneficial in free diving, where they hold their breath for extraordinarily long times. But it's not that their CO2 levels don't rise to be much higher than you and I would. You and I would not be able to tolerate those CO2 levels. At least I couldn't. And so we have to be a little bit careful when we talk about these extreme free divers, who do amazing things that may be partially due to a genetic mutation in this particular gene. And as far as I know, no one has done the research to actually look at whether or not they have this mutation.
Gotcha. Okay. I have two more questions for you, and then I will let you start your morning as I see the light continuing to rise in your office. The first is, and the related question, which is mouth breathing versus nose breathing. Is there a material impact on health and well-being if you're a mouth breather or a nose breather? And similarly, I notice in various breath work sessions that I do that they strongly encourage you to breathe through the diaphragm as opposed to through the lungs. And I'm wondering if there's any evidence or data around an impact on that as well.
Both good questions. I think the literature is supportive of the principle that nasal breathing at rest is beneficial compared to mouth breathing. There are all sorts of things that there are signals coming from your olfactory mucosa that are important in brain function. There are release of various compounds that are associated with nasal breathing that don't happen with mouth breathing. Mouth breathing, though, is sometimes essential. Your nasal passages are limited in their caliber and their size, and when you have to significantly increase your ventilation, it's difficult, if not impossible, at very high levels of ventilation. I mean, right now you're breathing at 5 liters per minute air in and out of your airways. You can easily handle that through your nose, through your nasal passages, but there's a point at which your nasal passages can't handle it, and you need to open up your mouth to take advantage of the much larger caliber upper airways. So I would say breathing during through the nose is beneficial. There are anecdotal reports, I don't know of any strong published reports, that individuals who mouth breathe during sleep can benefit by taping their mouths closed. Whether or not this applies to all individuals, I have not seen a good study, but it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I haven't scoured the literature. But speaking to colleagues who treat patients who have sleep breathing problems, they say that many of their patients report improvement by getting one of these innocuous tapes to keep them, to assure them that they nasal breathe. And I'm sorry, what was the second question?
Diaphragm breathing versus...
I see that as instructive, but at my level of understanding, I don't know enough to make a comment on that.
Right.
I think individuals, it's sort of, I'm mostly interested in the everyday Joe and Jane kind of introduction to breath work. And here again, it's about exercise. 95% of people just go out and jog, get on an exercise bike, and lift a few weights, and that's fine. But for people who are interested in optimizing their performance, they're interested in strength, power, and so on, there are different exercise regimens which are attuned to that. So if you're a power lifter, you're going to be doing a different set of exercises than a sprinter. And people who are at more advanced levels and have done a lot of breath work may indeed find that particular breath patterns are optimal for them. Whether or not this is strongly evident for people who are less experienced, I mean, we have to be attentive here. You have individuals who spend hours a day practicing meditation and breath work, and they're may have the ability to do things that those of us who don't devote that kind of time simply don't have access to do. You know, Michael Jordan can take off from the foul line and dunk. And I don't think that's a prescription for most of us, even though he finds it rather routine to do. And so I think we have to be careful in parsing out. And please, I don't want people writing in comments on this. I'm not dissing on this. I'm just expressing my reserve about not construing my proselytizing about the utility of breathwork to something that's saying these more advanced forms don't have any benefit. I'm saying the experimental data behind these advanced forms of breathwork are much slimmer than those behind the basic breathwork. And clearly, this has been known for thousands of years. So yeah. I want to make sure people don't misconstrue my interest in this and my ability to put my two cents in as any attempt to say that breathwork didn't exist till I came along. My contribution is to understanding what is happening in the brain that is allowing changes in breathing pattern to have an effect on emotion and cognition.
Perfect. I have one last question, which is, what is your focus for the coming year? Is there any work in particular that you're excited about that may be coming out in this general subject?
Well, we have our paper on teaching mice breath work and the effect it has on fear in review. I think that will have some impact because hopefully if it particularly gets out in the general press, it might convince individuals who think breath work is sort of too woo for them and, too much in too much Instagram influencer kind of level is really could benefit them and they'll give it a shot. And then we're going to pursue these experiments to try and better understand what the mechanisms are by which breath work is inducing changes in breathing. The other thing that excites me is I've been working with my colleague, Helen Lavretsky, who's a psychiatrist who works on breath work and treating patients who have clinical anxiety, clinical depression, whatnot. And we're working together to try and get an institute at UCLA on breathing and emotion, where we can really go full bore from non-human animal studies to human studies to try and get really deep as to what the mechanisms are and to see, once we understand the mechanisms, if there may be optimal ways that this can be used to benefit the human condition, both in individuals who have everyday stress levels, everyday issues that this might help, to people who have clinical problems of depression, panic, and anxiety.
Well, that sounds like great work. I hope that proceeds and everything comes together. Jack, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for getting up early, although you were up early already. I understand.
Thanks, Ronan. I am grateful for your interest. And I think that this is something that the public needs to know about, and your podcast is one of the ways that it can be done. And I encourage people to explore the interest and follow their curiosity. And I have to say that give it a shot, and if it does work for you, you'll find benefits. And if it doesn't work for you, there's no loss.
Well, there you go, folks. Stay curious, breathe properly. And while I can't get Jack necessarily to endorse eating beets, we're pretty close. So thank you so much, Jack. Really appreciate your time today. I hope you have a great day and look forward to continuing the dialogue.
Well, let's stay in touch. It's great. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Jack.
Bye now.